There are, apparently the Senate's uptight because there aren't any public accountants on the board.
Oh, they are now, huh? Older than now. Now, I moved that accountancy bill, you know, we moved a big accountancy bill that Rhodey or Raider put in, one of the two guys.
Oh, where's it started?
Wasn't that the May is to shell them? I was adding my notes.
Oh.
Yes.
You have, oh, that's right, the drafters said that shell would, that if you have May, they definitely can't do it. If you put shall, it has just the opposite effect of legally of what you want it to do. They said may not is specific, you may not do it, but shall, to them anyway, gives some sort of hazy language.
You use shall when you're saying you positive, and you use may not if you want to do something negative, say negative.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they shall do something.
You shall do something.
If you want to do something, you use may not. And if you want to say you will do it, then you've got to use shall. Mandated.
Yeah, yeah. May gives a discretionary power, is that the word may?
No. May not.
Oh, may not.
If you want to prohibit something, you say may not.
May not.
If you want to mandate doing something, then you say shall. That's the standard.
If you want to leave it open, you say may.
Anyway, that was a change that the drafter made because it doesn't comply with our draft. We're going to get the meeting going. And basically what it's all about, there's been some concern expressed about whether or not the Board of Accountancy is in compliance with the statute in terms of particular qualifications are set out in the statutes dealing with the number of members who are supposed to be CPAs, PAs, and public members. I think perhaps the best way to start it off might be by having Ms. Andrew, give us a rundown on the current makeup of the board.
This is not at all a current listing.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, these two are CPAs.
All five of these people listed are CPAs.
All five?
Yes.
That's all right.
Vern Johnson's term has expired, and he's been either reappointed nor has his replacement. Since then, two additional persons have been appointed to the board. Myrna McDougall, she is from Juneau and an officer of Ian Barron Train. She is not a CPA, she's a user of CPA services. And the other appointment is Margaret Baker from Nome. She's a businesswoman. It's beautiful ivory and jade jewelry, so it's a small business that she owns. Services. After the amendment to this act last session, the legislature, not yet to admit, we had two public members, so therefore we're not looking for two public members to make the appointment, and not pay any attention to the details of that. The construction, the language was changed in there, whereas before it had said that at least three of the members would be CPAs. It now says that, you know, drop the at least, and says, three members of the board shall be CPAs, two members of public accounts, two members lay people. And there has been, the issue was raised, I think Charlotte Stewart contacted me perhaps 3 or 4 months ago and asked, but she said, I just noticed this, is the board privately constituted? I said, I really don't know, but I'll say that I doubt it. And I asked the Attorney General, which I did not receive back, but I do receive it, the answer will be that no, there should be, two of the CPA members should be replaced by.
Well,
won't that, is that going to be cumbersome since there are only 7 or 11 or there's not going to drop them? What happens if the 7 or 11?
Seven.
Well, there are 11.
Seven.
Seven. I think there are still 11, Mr. Carr, but I don't believe that all of the 11 CPAs are active.
What if, and you've got to have a couple of counties, and what if only one out of the seven will serve? Are you going to be de facto in violation of the law?
Well, I don't believe so. I think that you can leave a position vacant and not be in violation of the law. I don't think that you can appoint anyone other than a public employee to fill that position. But I'm not positive. I don't know of any instance where a position left vacant constitutes a violation of the law. As I stated, it would be to appoint someone other than a PA.
So that the two appointments being made this year to bring it in compliance with the 76th Amendment in terms of the two members being appointed this year, the public members that are being appointed to bring it into compliance with the requirements set last year. Right. I'm not sure.
It's out of our telephone directory that we use in the office, and I know that mine is up to date and has the other members. So.
Chat.
Mr. Chairman, could you?
She's an officer with the VA Parent. I don't recall her exact title.
Miss Andrews, we have now, I have written two names in that you have given me. There are two public, quote, unquote, members. And I have five typewritten names above that. The top four of those, Derringer, Tim, Ratcliffe, and Stewart, they are on the board now.
Yes, sir. They have not been removed.
And Vern Johnson's appointment expires when?
It has expired.
It expired
last April.
All right.
And he has been neither replaced nor reappointed. Generally, board members continue to serve until their successor has been appointed. As far as I know, there are no plans to reappoint because of this requirement.
We're right to the point of the game. Have you or your department taken affirmative action to get a public accountant to replace Vern Johnson?
No, sir, I have not.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bradley?
You say all of these, and you're not sure that they're all current, but over here, this is supposed to be our eight. Four are still current, and they all seem to be.
Do you have a copy of the statute before you, or the amendment that was? This, I suppose it's a rather embarrassing question for somebody to ask who probably helped put the law in the books by voting for it last year, but what are the last two sentences of that paragraph mean? They appear to be contradictory to me, but.
The only change was to add that except for public members, and I really don't know what they mean.
Certainly appears that the first sentence requires somebody to hold their certificate or license, and the second implies that appointees don't have to hold.
I agree with it, Mr. Chairman.
The statute itself refers to both certificates and permits. And the only thing I'd tell you would be that the person, the certificate is considered perhaps to be an ongoing thing. Once you've been awarded your certificate as a certified public accountant, you don't lose that, then the permit then would be the payment of fees.
Mr. Carpenter?
If I understand this correctly, this section requires that we have two of our grandfathered PAs whose only function on the board would be to represent themselves in the other five. That's
unless we pass this change, the county I can replace.
Well, Mr. Chairman, didn't we hear from the CPAs that it's real confusing because they allege that, that anybody can come in and take the test and be a public accountant. So currently, and then the public accountants argued yes, but it's if we pass the the public accountancy section of the CPA, you say everything being equal, why would we have to, you know, we could be a CPA, but I mean, the law as it is now allows people that want to be public accountants to come and take the test and be public accountants. It just so happens that because of the non-germaneness or the inequity of the test or something, I guess people don't avail themselves of it. But currently, somebody can take portions of the CPA test and hypothetically become a public accountant.
Yes, the provision of the statute, the requirements for a public accountant don't require them specifically, but there is high school degree, and then there's an experience requirement. You don't require the degree for years. When you meet that, then you're eligible to be the examination. I don't know when the last time a public accountant or a would-be public accountant sat for that examination. I'm sure it's sometime in the 60s, though.
Okay, Senator Pong. Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just a little confused for purposes of meeting. I thought maybe we have a little policy that we would have compliance with the statute. I noticed that two of these members who are present now have a term expiring.
Well, I'm not sure that there is a crisis. I had understood that some members of the Senate were concerned about this, and that since these two appointments were up and they are going to be considered in joint session, that perhaps the joint committee ought to take a look at it. But Senator McDougall and Baker, but apparently these are the two new appointments for lay membership, so there's right. So. Senator Bradley?
All right. In regards to the question, Jim, you're right, and this came up as a result of quite a hassle between our CPA witnesses and vice and accountant witnesses, how it some of them. And mostly after the meeting, talking to them in the car and whatnot, they thought it was most unclear, but it was made mention of in the committee meeting. But they had so many CPAs, and I think they had a right to feel that they were discriminated against. And obviously the governor, for some reason, because of conflict of interest, is someone would accept otherwise, put too many CPAs on here illegally, so.
I don't think you were illegal when you called them made. Were proper when they were made, but after this amended, I feel guilty to not know you.
But anyway, the thing is, we could, this, that little problem, check it very quickly.
So, unless someone else makes mention of it, I'll make the point to emphasize the fact that we only want three CPAs under current statute. At the time, we didn't have a statute before, someone looked it up, we just took everybody's word for it. But obviously, as Sharon says, at the time, it wasn't illegal, but it has since become legal.
Are there any other questions?
I don't think it's probably a waste of time.
Okay. There are no other questions, and nobody has any other comments on the subject, then Mr. Carpenter. Senator Pullman? Mr. Hayes?
I think that at some point in the future we're going to have to amend this section related to appointment qualification boards, even if for two reasons. One, if we license this new group, as I understand it, right now they're going to be called licensed accountants, and there's no provision in here for licensed accountants, so that would have to be an amendment. We want to include them under this, or we may want to take a look at reducing the number of representatives of the public accountants, because I understood even further that there are less than seven. There were seven, but then two have recently sold their businesses to CPAs, so there may be only five practicing public accountants in the state. And anyway, it just looks like at some point in the future, maybe the next session, we might want to change, make a change here, like whatever happened.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Andrews, I'm trying to figure out how to make a statement into a question. So I'll make a statement and ask you if the question, if the statement is has any validity or not, okay? If the, first of all, does the Board of Accountancy have the statutory authority, which I believe they do, to establish the examination procedure for CPAs and also establish an examination procedure for public accountants? I assure you that the statute does have that authority.
In this instance, I believe that the statute specifically requires that the board use the AICPA examination for CPAs if it's available. And then I don't think it's addressed in the public account area. I think it's spelled out in the statute that they use the AICPA exam if available.
Oh, if that's the case, I have no further questions. Thank you very much.
Mr. Parr?
Yeah, yes. What if we do with the public accountancy bill, one way or another? Hayes was talking about whatever section of the bill is by. You'll both think. That's what the term is. We don't set up this public accountancy thing. It changes back to the way.
Mr. Bradley? Any other questions or comments on this topic? If there are no other questions, then we'll adjourn the joint meeting. And
do we have work to do?
Yeah, we have a...
If we're informal, what I think I'd like to see done is have it filled and then have committee with this. And then our joint committee make a recommendation as to whether we let public accounts disrupt or whether we keep it. Rather us. In other words, see, that'll give you three CPAs. Two members of the public, two public accountants, and they get thrashed out and get out of their goddamn court. Monkey on their back.
Yeah, get it off of our.
That's right.
Did everybody answer?
Buy a big gavel.
Do I have one?
You're kidding.
Told him buy a big, they make a big gap. Thanks a lot, Glenn. Have a good day.
We're going to have a short day. We've got a fantastic calendar considering it consists of two resolutions today.
We have a great calendar, too. What I do with it is, you know, we have a very powerful calendar before us.
What's this today?
You've got 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm a Senate.
A Senate bill on there.
Two resolutions.
I don't even bills are concurrent resolutions. CR, don't they?
But not
two resolutions and one Senate bill.
You got your work cut out for you.
We have four votes right now there. We have four of sponsors.
Majority of sponsors.
Is
say the thing.
Generate in the house.
I just want I just want the members of the committee to realize this is a very unprecedented action. Two consecutive Republican bills in this committee. We handled one of your ends yesterday and one of yours tonight.
I heard he's not. He wasn't even here.
He wasn't here.
Still,
still, still,
still, still,
still
a state
shocker. Well, why don't we... This end of the committee, will, this end of the table will operate as a...
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
What?
I don't have a copy of the bill, but there it says in the Senate. I know it says, no, but the December bill in the Senate, which deals in the same...
Thank you, Joe.
Okay.
In a different manner, but it solved the same problem we have, and that is Ziegler's bill. And there is a memorandum over Department of Revenue from the ABC board, which tentatively endorses the concept. In as much as that, it's highly restricted. We're talking about servicemen on active duty in uniform. In other words, if they come to a club and they're not a member, you'd be able to tell that they're in uniform. And I said, historically, the American Legion and the VFW clubs in Alaska, which are 10 or 16 up, had a very good relationship with the service programs and servicemen. As a matter of fact, the only way that VFW and the American Legion are composed entirely of ex-military men and also military men on active duty. So it's an association that is not evident in other clubs like the Moose or the Elks. What we're asking here is that that this association be recognized in a manner which allows these military men in uniform on active duty the privileges of the club facilities.
Mr. Park.
Sorry about that. I'm just, you know.
Mr. Kettering.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question, just for the hell of it. When a National Guard person is on his 2 weeks of military duty, does that also qualify? I just thought of that. Is he on active duty? I presume he is.
Yeah, he is on active duty.
He would qualify.
You're federalized.
Thank you.
The other 50 weeks a year, they would
be. He would not be. That's what I thought. Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions? I have one piece of advice. Don't show this sheet to Lisa Rudd.
I know, I was thinking
which
about
one?
This morning.
The sheet about the VFW, the membership requirements.
Oh.
VFW requirements must be a male.
I didn't realize that, but
I know the American Legion, of course, has an all ladies post in Anchorage. Laura Borealis post in there.
Yeah.
All this means is the person
right. You know, nowadays, the person, military men do wear uniforms, only on special occasions, like we have a number of them come down to Sitka, Alaska, and they come there on the 4th of July and take part in our celebration. They have a band and the parade and so on and so forth, and they're uniform all the time. And there are guests in the community, and I think you should be treated as guests throughout the community.
Hassle down there, but it's fine.
Hassle, I mean, of course, the law enforcement people have been very lenient with us, but nevertheless, it's a violation of the law.
I have one other item of business. It's a note from the staff, and it says we need money for Monday's coffee. No money, no coffee. So those of you who haven't been contributing to the coffee may want to drop. Okay, is there anybody who wants to testify today that hasn't had a chance to testify before? Okay.
Conservation would like to, but Commissioner Muller should be here soon.
Okay, fine. Mike, did you have any additional comments on the bill?
Yeah, I'll make two or three reasons, Mr. Chairman. Nothing formal. Just before the weekend, one conversation with me and another conversation with Representative Greeny, Barney Gottstein of the Barney Gottstein contacted me. And the members of the committee, I'm sure, will find it interesting and perhaps encouraging to know that he's in favor of this kind of legislation, which I think will be a great step up, as much as I'm not familiar with the acre scheme entirely, but I think he is either one of the largest or certainly one of the largest chains of grocery stores in Alaska to have the manager of that organization backing this type of legislation is very helpful. His representation to me was that he goes along with the bill just as it's written right now. However, he did have some additional suggestions in the area of strengthening the redemption center concept, because despite the fact that if nothing else was available, he would go along with the bill just as it's written right now. He thinks there are probably ways that the redemption center concept strengthened that we can get rid of some of the headaches that the bill necessarily is placing on the retailer. And I'm certainly anxious to accommodate that group of Alaskans, grocery store retailers, for that matter, the grocery store retailers, if we can do so. So over the weekend, I've been trying to work up conceptually a little bit of a change. And interestingly enough, what we kind of seem to be moving toward is the redemption center concept that was embodied in that Coors suggested national uniform bottle bill. What we're trying to set up is a machinery whereby the state could, by contract, not by hiring a lot of additional state employees, but by contract, work with local profit groups or non-profit groups, whatever the case may be, and have these bottles and cans picked up by a redemption center organization. A big town like Anchorage, probably on a daily basis, in a smaller community like Juneau, for instance, maybe we're talking about twice a week, and in a still smaller community, maybe we're talking about once a week or even less week. But in any case, you're trying to strengthen this redemption center section so that there would be an organization to pick these bottles and cans up, do the sorting, cut down on the warehouse space that would be necessary for the retailer. The problem, obviously, is who's going to pay for that? The question kind of answered itself a little bit in that hopefully, for instance, again, in the case of aluminum cans, an actual profit can be made on the, I'm not sure that there's that much profit to be made. Obviously, we've got to work out a way where the redemption center works into the nickel cycle. So I guess what I'm telling you right now is that if you like that concept, I'll continue to explore it. And I'd like to have a few days to work out the suggestions for the substitute for the committee to consider. In addition, if you like the concept, please go ahead and put the sunset clause that the Representative Greeny suggested in there. I think that's the strength of the bill. No question in our minds that 4.5 years down the pipe, this concept would be so strongly accepted by Alaskans that they're clamoring to really enact the legislation. And then in addition, we've identified a couple of very small areas that need changing. We noticed in the Coors suggested bill that the retailer should have the option of refusing to accept damaged bottles. That's so obvious that I had never thought of it, and I guess none of us did, but really, the safeguard should be in there because somebody brings in a nicked bottle. It's a violence from a redemption standpoint, so we have to put just one liner in there. It's been suggested as well that we give the retailer the option of refusing to accept unclean bottles. That creates a tiny bit of a problem in the need a definition of unclean, but I was under since Ruth yesterday, but the day before. I think that's a problem that's not really all that devastating. It's a little bit like, I think it was Justice Brandeis that said he couldn't decline pornography, but he knew it when he saw it. And I think maybe an unclean bottle, I don't know if you can define it or not, but if somebody brings in a spongy, dirty bottle of cake, you know, a bunch of gunk, obviously it's obviously dirty. So we would make those changes as well. He has some additional questions. That's kind of where we're at.
Are there any questions, Mr. Hayes?
It has nothing to do with what we just talked about, Mike, but over on the second page regarding the areas where item, I guess about line 13. But anyway, it just has to do with the areas that are, which I presume here by reference, are the areas that are going to be subject to this bill. And that Anchorage, Ketchikan, Juneau, Kodiak, Fairbanks, and everybody else is excluded more or less. Have you checked out, for instance, Kodiak? Be sure that they're not going to be adversely impacted as compared to some of the others.
No, I haven't, Mr. Chairman. That's probably a good question. Maybe we have to check it out a little further. Our thought was that Kodiak was probably in more or less the same category, for instance, in Southeast Alaska, because of that regular ferry system. It didn't be any more difficult for bottles to be transported, for instance, on the ferries, than it would be here in Southeast Alaska. I've got just a little bit of a rumble from Representative Snyder that perhaps the transportation system isn't really comfortable. For instance, I'd forgotten about it. Well, apparently they go for a couple of months at least every winter when there's no ferry service whatsoever. I don't know how satisfactory the otherwise barge and ship traffic is in and out of Kodiak, so that's probably something we should look into. As you remember the first day in there, did what happened to the bush. If we had included them, the people in the bush would have just been stuck with the nickel, or actually the retailer would have been stuck with the nickel in the bush, which meant that they had the price up and adjusting there, and there'd be no way to keep that nickel rolling as it does in the non-bush areas. And we determined that that's going to be the case in Kodiak also, then you know, we ought to exclude them. But I don't have enough facts other than this. I've got muted rumbles, so it's a source that you have, so should look into that too.
John?
Oh, that's what he is that I was going to question hearing. I don't know. But what was the thinking of which area this would be? In other words, do we still continue to get this stuff in the non travel bottles as well? So we have both kinds coming in from the push areas getting out of
I think the bush areas would still get the return on this, just like anybody else. The trouble is, they would still end up being one way, in spite of the fact that they were returned. So that anything consigned to a bush area store, for instance, the distributor would not put the extra nickel on, and then when it got out to the bush store, the bush retailer would not put the extra nickel on. I don't think there'd be anything to be gained by having two kinds of bottles.
Was there some sort of evidence that in first year,
no concrete evidence, but I think there's a general consensus among just virtually everybody. I've got two or three letters to the contrary, people saying there should be information, but even so, in spite of those letters, I'm still convinced that at this moment in history, there's a real hardship in the bush. I just don't have to. When you have to deliver stuff out there in Cessna 180s, I just question whether it is economic under any circumstances to fly particularly bottles back. Now, in a very short time, maybe 3 or 4 years, 10 years, whatever it takes, if we can accommodate this need, we really should know how to do so, because the bush is as much, or litter is as much, in fact, as in some respects, for work all in the bush than it is in urban areas. But if there's no use bringing them under this bill if it's not going to help. And as far as I can determine, right now, given the particularly the very small industries, their transportation systems served by very small planes, and they have no service transportation to speak of. All we'd just be doing is adding a nickel to the cost of the food beverage. No way for anybody to reclaim that nickel to keep it from chicken going
Or how do we go? One final question, Mr. Chairman. My other business is the unclean spot of the convention.
No.
I'm afraid I tend to disagree with that. That's, I don't think you do this at all. It's too loud to reject the problem. After all, if you're having sterilized, wants to sterilize, they can reuse it anyway. And, you know, you have as I would gather, probably a lot of the returns of bottles, we've got kids making like those boxes. They've got to go back and make them, find some place to get them clean. And question what it is, the guy turns it down. I think it's a bit of militating against the ineffective program. We all know that the bottler has to go through his whole rigmarole anyway. He's doing it perfectly. He has to go through exactly the same procedure to sterilize and wash and sterilize.
Yeah, you could very well be right. Out of all the points I brought up, it means the least to me. It's just that some of the several retailers have mentioned this. Mr. Haynes from Sitka and several others have mentioned this sanitary situation. It seemed to be a great concern to them. I think once we get into the program, but that's going to be, you know, not the type of problem. It certainly apparently is not a problem in Oregon, and I haven't heard that it's any problem whatsoever in Vermont. Just parking back in the old days of picking up bottles myself when I was a kid, I can't recall it was a problem. But as I say, several retailers mentioned it, and I thought if we could accommodate them with some language like that. But I do admit that there's a definitional problem. If you want to get into definitions, then it really is a problem, because the ultimate cleanliness, I guess, is a sterile bottle, and that certainly it's not the intent to make people sterilize bottles before they drink. So,
Joe,
I'd like to follow up on questions by Representative Parr on the Bush bottle problem again. How are you going to administer that? How is it going to be handled in getting the same bottle out of the bush without the nickel round robin there? You got to be exempt from the nickel. Is it do you have to be a store owner or a dealer out in the bush? For instance, if I went in and told them I was going out for a couple of weeks in the bush camping or something, and put some of the bottle back, well, then I would seem to be, I would be out of luck. But it's got to be.
Yeah. You'd be out of luck. You know, frankly, I think I'll be out of luck.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing, you know, we don't want people calling panels or calling the bottles and cans on a camping trip.
And you're sure it isn't economical that it wouldn't be economical for someone to take all those bottles over there at zero cost and bring them back in and some dealer for nickel?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd be amazed, really amazed if that would be, you know, particularly given the time and effort to be involved in the cost of trading. In fact, the whole reason for excluding the bush is that it's uneconomic if it's coming one way, so I can't imagine that it would be economic to take them out and bring them back.
Any other questions? Thank you. You'd like the committee then to hold off until you can draft some?
Yeah, I want to get with the department a little bit more.
Okay.
Commissioner Mueller hasn't even heard my latest thing on this. I want to coordinate with him.
Okay.
Thank you.
Commissioner, if we hear from the department.
Testify. Just want to make a general remark. I don't know whether we had an opportunity to get a copy of our analysis and recommendations to the government on this particular bill. But over the last year and a half or so, we have talked to various members of the legislature, including Representative Miller and Governor about this. The administration is the governor particularly, very supportive of this type of legislation. The question about redemption centers, I discussed this with some of our staff recently, and I understand Representative Miller wishes to rewrite part of that section so that it's clear what the redemption center purpose is. Probably a good idea. When I read it through, I didn't understand what that particular section was trying to do. I think the idea there is to allow a consortium of grocery stores or distributors and retailers to set up a single drop point where everybody would go in to redeem their bottles and they wouldn't have to go to 19 different grocery stores. And that's probably a fair concept. I understand it was in the law in Oregon and nobody has bothered to do that. Set up an injection center for the situation to last, it would be quite different. I think some of the questions about what happens in the rural areas can be solved by this bottle marking system that's referred to in the bill, where the bottles that are essentially going through the system with a 5-cent deposit are marked, and those that are going out in the rural areas outside of the deposit system are not going. That can solve some of the problems of people flying out their airplanes and loading full empty bottles and dumping them up, flooding the market, so to speak. Those are sort of important things that would be fairly well handled. I think the bill itself is fairly self-enforcing, which is kind of nice from our standpoint, because that means it cuts down on the amount of costs involved in government managing the bill. There are a couple of studies required in there, and those are going to cost some money, and I think we sent a fiscal note back through the system to bring a copy of the window. But if you want to retain those in there, it's probably a pretty good idea. It's going to cost us some one-shot costs. The remainder of the bill, I think, is fairly straightforward and really doesn't amount to very much. I know there's been a lot of controversy about the situation in Washington and the fact that they have what they call the Washington Bottler Control Act. We've studied that over the last couple of years and looked at it. And I guess that there's kind of a contest between Washington and Oregon as to whose streets are cleaner or dirtier, in the case may be. Travel was most of us do wandering around Seattle. I'm not at all sure that the kinds of problems we're trying to solve in this type of legislation is entirely different than the problems of the Washington Bottler Control Act. So, just wanted to indicate the administration's support for this legislation. We're going to help the committee and the sponsor.
Are there any questions for Commissioner Mueller? Okay, thank you. Does anybody else want to testify on the bill?
I have a question.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we're shipping out the debt. Does this mean that we're going to have two types, say Coca-Cola cans, with a deposit on them?
That's one thing, at least in my mind, is still a little unclear. And
we have a problem because we ship, for example, take the word called Estrella to Casamigo or to Quinault. We ship sometimes 4 and 5 van loads of Coca-Cola, 7 soda pop orange and whatnot out to those areas. Same in the fall again. Those are deposits.
comments on that, Mike?
Yeah, I, my thought was that they didn't have to be, I mean, because if you have a smoke mark and smoke not, I didn't think they'd need any more, because they, it seemed to me that the very thing that makes it uneconomic to even serve the bush makes it doubly uneconomic for anybody that, might say, even pop cans, ship bush cans back and with no costs to pay. My thought was that any bottles that were going to be consigned to the bush, the extra thing you put on, when you go out there, just one way, and they just, right now, so finally, the dump out there. I just can't imagine that it's worthwhile for anybody to bring them back. We may have to do some checking and some alter that.
Do you have a question?
Just to follow up on my previous question and comment, there is a lot of one-way freighting out there, and particularly in some of the old converted military cargo planes and that sort of thing. And, carry a tremendous amount of freight. It would not be uneconomical for them, but with a zero, practically a zero cost, back off. I just think that ought to be looked into to be sure that somebody doesn't profit or that there's an unnecessary loss to virtue because of that possibility. In one sense, it would be good to get it back, because that's what we're after. Except the nickel is. Except the nickel gets lost in the process. Okay, we'll check it out.
Charlie?
Kim, I wonder if anybody who's present, since I missed the first meeting, tell why they put the cartons down under the definition of beverage container. The carton companies may support the cartons and put filters on it. That's the definition of page 5 and 5.
The definition of beverage is so restricted that the way that doesn't matter, except I think.
Well, I was wondering because the cartons probably couldn't be used. They are biodegradable and all sorts of things like that. So I wondered why they were included at all.
Probably should not have.
Blair?
Mike, let's imagine that I live in Meadows and I'm buying a case of Coca-Cola. Where would I be buying that container?
I live in Meadows. As a retailer, you mean?
No, as a just a person. I live and work in Meadows.
I presume what you mean. Ready, sir.
What? Well, let's go. Okay, let's take that route for starters. And say I go into the store there and I buy a carton of Coca-Cola. And why couldn't I pay my 5-cent deposit at that store, and when I bring my cans back to that store, get my deposit back?
And Bill?
No.
Well, the reason we took them out of it is because you could. At that point, the system breaks down, because when we question whether really economic for the retailer then to ship by the cans on a frequently small one, it says no one even has something to ship that back by the air, and that's usually what
why would we have to? Why wouldn't we just go dump it in the dump?
Well, then he will have put out a nickel and never gotten it back, so what do you, in essence, have done, had to pass it on to the customer, although the customer didn't care. Nickel cycle has to start and stop in the same place in order for everybody to kind of leave it. See, the retailer there in Petals bought the carton and paid an extra nickel on the distributor, which is what we're talking about. He then sold it to the customer. The customer paid the nickel, but then he brought it back to the retailer. So the retailer then paid the customer back the nickel. So at this point, particulars out on nickel. And if he doesn't send it back to the distributor, he loses it. But the trouble is, it may be more expensive for him to ship that thing back than whatever get out of the nickel value.
Now it's taken to Juneau, and the same thing happens. Does this mean that the dealer has to return the cans across to the distributor who takes them to the dump?
I've got to do a little bit of checking and find out just what the distribution system is in the Southeast Boston. As I understand it, the distributor here is actually located in Seattle. So the nickel process begins and ends with the retailer under that circumstance. Now, I may be wrong. In fact, it's maybe going to be coming.
Can it begin and end with the retailer and metal?
Well, here's the good. But then there's no chance. That's gotten rid of it from the standpoint of it's got to take one place you can take to the dump. But there's absolutely no opportunity for recycling reuse, which isn't our primary goal, but it's a very strong secondary goal.
Right, but it, because the primary goal would still be affected in the bush in the same way that it very likely be affected here for the time being, why are we excluding the bush?
What's the primary goal? A strong secondary goal. You know, it has been to get these cans and the bottles back in. Even though it's secondary, it's still very, very important.
Right. But as a practical matter, we can operate on the assumption that we expect a lot of these to go to the dump, and the secondary will not be achieved. Mm-hmm. And as a practical matter, recognizing that there are cans and bottles strewn all over the metals too.
Do you want to make a comment?
Yes, I'd like to make a comment, possibly a little testimony. I just came down from the Bettles area, but about the returning thing from Bettles and anywhere in the bush, usually the back hauls are empty, to where I don't think there'd be any problem really in getting container shipped back to State of Burgess in general. And also, like, from Bettles, it's nice and supply for the freight down, to where I don't believe that'd be a very large cost for how many cans you'd have. Where I would think the bush should be considered seriously. Because the freight is hard getting things out for release, but possibly by having this backhaul, that might even help on the cost of these charters, because some of these charters are paid just for one way, and you're paying both ways on the charter even if it comes back in. Where possibly with that nickel could possibly use to help, in a sense, help pay for these flies, not subsidizing them all, but it would help to take care of some of the costs, so it could be split up.
The nickel can't put milk at all. The wash. Everybody pays nickel, everybody gets nickel back. So as far as assisting with the subsidizing the life, that doesn't help at all. That's part of the problem. It's got to do it purely on its own value. And because frankly, the nickel value there, particularly in the case of bottles, I mean, nothing cans, they can smash, so it's basically quite a problem. But in the case of bottles, it's a lot more bulk.
Also, just like CO2 support concept.
Can we identify it, please?
Yeah, could we get your name for the tape? So?
Jim Schwarber, S-C-H-W-A-R-B.
Thank you. Charlie?
Chairman, I just wanted to follow up a little bit about this S-C-H-W-A-R-B. I think it's a good idea. Everybody agrees it's a good idea of yours. But I don't really think myself that we're taking a realistic approach. We're really, in a sense, trying to get something done. We all know it. I'd like to ask if the DEC or whoever couldn't sit here, Mr. Cullen's asking to be held up, couldn't give us a physical note what's involved in any necessary freight subsidy. So we can do the thing, including the push, we can make sure that the container does not go to the dump, we can ship back to the bottlers and the distributors, we don't call them back to Seattle. And in other words, you know, if we want to do it at all, let's just do it right. Let's find out what it would actually cost us to do it. And we can decide, okay, is it worth as much as the taxpayers worth? But I think what we're looking at here is an attempt to do something free, which in the long run is just not going to do the job. And the hauling to the dump is, in my mind, an unacceptable solution. Might be, of course, you'd say, well, the cost is so high that we can't go that route, ship them back. But until we get some kind of an estimate, we don't know. For example, we all know that backhaul out of Alaska is pretty much empty. Whether it's trucks, whether it's Alaska Railroad going back to Fairbanks area, back to Seward, whether it's these ships that go back to Royal 48, we all know they all are practically empty. I don't know if there's any possibility of getting some sort of break-even freight rate on all these different ways. They haul this sort of as a public service. They don't make any money on it. They don't lose any money, but they don't make any either. So it might be possible to do something like that. It might be at the cost, it might be at the high. Well, would you like to see that?
Chet?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sure would like to endorse Parr's suggestion and even expand it to include all litter type materials, not just a portion of what creates our total litter, but the entire package.
John?
Mike, I'd just like to follow up on what Trevor said. It seems to me that there are two considerations, the primary consideration, and there's the energy consideration for the reuse of the containers. But I think just the primary consideration is an important goal. Go along with the concept of the bill. For that reason, I don't see that you couldn't attain that goal in the bush. It starts with the retailer there and ends with the retailer there, and he's responsible, and it's his problem to dump it out from the local dump, as opposed to laying all over town. And in response to Representative Parr's comment about maybe trying to get a fiscal note, I'm just looking at something here that I think was handed to Larry by Don Magnuson. It's something from the Associated Oregon Industries Digest. And just there's a sentence in here that says that relating to the costs. The arguments between the opponents and the proponents regarding the deposit return concept. It says evidence is clear that the expense burden is heavy, but there is no practical way to determine accurate figures. And I just want to point that out. That's what that says. That's what this article says. It is difficult to determine what an accurately determine a fiscal note. Doesn't seem though that to me that
maintaining the primary objective, just to get it from the retailer and back around the retailer again and get rid of it. That would be maybe the primary objective. It might not be the greatest cost involved. Maybe it's secondary. We maintain the secondary objective along with the primary that we get into the heavy cost.
Charlie?
I think it should be possible to quantify those things, Jim. I believe it. People down the need to hold the wholesale distributors of beer and soft drinks in space to know pretty accurately how many cans and bottles they ship from various places in which state. And if we did have any ideas what kind of subsidy, if any, would be required for backhaul purposes, then it should be possible to quantify the cost.
I have a feeling that if we really try to get in, we have the litter goal and we have the waste goal. I have a feeling that if here in Alaska, we try to get this bill too deeply into the waste end of it, we'll shoot down the whole bill.
Chen?
Mr. Chairman, along with Representative Parr's thoughts regarding the cost of backhauling, why, if the committee wishes, I'd like to further make a request for investigation, and that is the, well, we can just take a finite example of a tugboat with 210 barges returning from Anchorage to Seattle, and the difference in energy consumed between the tandem barges being empty and being the tandem barges being loaded. We'll get into this energy situation then.
Mike?
In all honesty, if you're going to break it down that close, that deep, just don't know the bill and just get it on it. Obviously, it's a big computer and set of businesses, at least a year, it's not due to determine the energy of both parties.
Shouldn't be too difficult, Mike. Really. But we know how much they burn coming north, and we know how much they burn going back empty. I don't know what the difference is.
You know, right now, the veneer will pay you, in fact, use for less than 2 cents a bottle, so I think that's not how much it costs to
Well, my only thought is that I've heard a lot of testimony given that this is going to be a great energy saver, and I want to find out how much energy it's going to save. Well, but you expend energy when you run a tugboat.
I'd say 15% is expended on that tugboat to go down.
Might be able to.
Chairman?
Sure, Mike, I'm not trying to kill the bill. I think if you said yourself, where you want to make some adjustments, I would like to say what you need to talk about. Did anybody ask the guy who flies these bottles out to that old place in storage to bring back empty? He's coming back completely empty. Let's say he had it. He's coming back empty, including money. He might make a little bit of a jump his overhead. I just don't know anybody's name.
There's already a very good barge race going right now. It's less than half of it is coming north. So, as a matter of fact, I'm curious. I asked him if anybody could consider back all the time.
I think that's what maybe one of those things would be all desirable is to be too expensive. I don't know, but we'll find out.
Are there any other questions or comments other than Bill? Does anybody else want to testify on it? Okay, what we'll do then is wait for Mike to get back with his proposed CS. And I think there are two things that if anybody in the committee objects to, but I'd like to, you know, they can let me know, but I'd like to see them included in your proposed CS to just save us the time. And one would be the provision for open containers in liquor stores. And the other is provision for allowing children into liquor stores for the purpose of returning empties or minors. If nobody else has anything, then we'll adjourn the meeting. Bill, 3:15 first. Yeah, Commissioner Gallagher?
Federal Congress approved expanding
the pollution control financing to small businesses, and they allowed the SBA to guarantee pollution control on loans up to $500,000. Our present bill had a limitation on loans that they all had to be bigger than $500,000. So one of the things that we attempted to knock out was this limitation. This is done in section 5. This limitation on the small size. If we knock out this provision, we can allow the state to sell to the Industrial Development Authority pollution control bonds for small businesses and have them guaranteed by the SBA so you can sell a AAA rated bond to finance a lot of these small businesses pollution control equipment. And I think it could be a very worthwhile program. What it makes sense for is a lot of the canneries and places like this small manufacturing facilities like that to take care of their solid waste disposal problems. And they can save quite a bit of interest under a federal guarantee. And I'd like to turn it over to Eric.
Do you have a question?
Currently, this bill, as it was originally written, was to include the establishment of industrial manufacturing plants. You said it's never been used. No one in this type of business ever sought any help under this bill?
They sought help, but they always ran into roadblocks under poor drafting of the language and things like that. We cleaned up a couple of drafting problems, too.
Poor drafting of the language in the bill?
Yes. One of the things that wasn't clear like in it was that down in section 3 where it says the old bill is kind of read like exempting the property from local taxation, but this act is not. There's still, even though we come in and you have a state property that you originally do a lease. Here's how the thing works. The State Industrial Development Authority comes in and leases a property. And then or buys a property and releases it back so they take it out. So the industrial firm takes it out. The fact that the state originally owned the thing, they make the thing tax exempt from local communities. That was never the intent. The local communities can still tax this facility because they have a leasehold interest in it. And so there was never intended to make these facilities tax exempt local. And one of the things that we do is make that very clear.
Okay, in other words, you're saying that this bill, as it's now, will be amended, or supposed to be amended, will encourage the establishment of industrial and manufacturing plants as well as facilities for pollution control and waste.
There are only three states in the Union, that's correct. There's only three states in the Union that can ever finance a pollution control or something under federal law. Us, Washington, and one other state. And Eric is involved with this act since inception, trying to get something done. We've got Ketchikan approved, and it looks like that one will finally go. Alaska Airlines wants to do a terminal in Anchorage this summer under it.
Yeah. Larry, did you have a question?
There are other attempts to use the
Well, one is a little snag where it isn't clear down in Section 3 whether the property is tax exempt or not. The Valdez issue was originally, under this.
I can give you, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
$265 billion issue.
Another question.
what I guess I don't understand is specifying including facilities for air and water transportation. That's fine. I'm going back to Joe's question here. The snags in this that are removed for air water, therefore, and so facto are also removed for industrial manufacturing plants.
The present only covers industrial plants. We've expanded it to include air and water transportation, pollution control, and waste disposal. Under the federal law, industrial plants can only be plants up to $5 million. And the exceptions to that are air and water transportation and pollution control. We want to expand it to cover those topics so you go through the $5 million ceiling. And that's what's allowed in the federal law.
Chen?
Thank you. When you use the term, I've heard you mention terminals and hangars and so forth and so on, but facilities, that's a broad term, I would imagine. Does that also apply to the ferry boat or the aircraft carrier?
Be honest, people can say, well, a
proliferation of Texas for industrial purposes may at some point jeopardize Texas energy for conventional purposes. Congress has not acted in this regard, and the benefit is available on the federal tax code.
One of the things I'd like to accomplish is to develop a program under Section E where you make the SBA guarantee the loans for the small business for inflation control. That's one of the real tough areas that small business has to accomplish is take care of our pollution problems. Any aid we give them in assisting them in that area is warranted. I'd like to have the authority to
you had said that right now there are a couple of projects, pollution control projects, pending. And is that because you need the specific language in the act?
They're pending under the facilities. That's what it's for, is pollution control. Is that not
right? Mr. Chairman, bond council has stated that the act is probably sufficient for pollution control facilities. The additional language makes it absolutely clear beyond any doubt. The rail basic thrust is the air and water transportation. The act speaks in terms of manufacturing a substance, and now we're talking about the effect of facility commerce and financing transportation facility.
Larry?
Do you know what specific proposed Alaska Airlines? They have an air terminal in Anchorage. It's a $5 million warehouse, new warehouse carpet. This probably saves $100,000 a year.
Any other questions?
Commissioner, could you go through just real briefly again how this thing works? Are we putting up the Alaska Airlines is going to sell some tax exempt bonds under the color of this law as amended? That's right. And do we back it up to full faith and credit?
Our credit is not involved.
Okay, we just sort of allow it because of the. It has to have state sanction in order to come under the federal sanction.
It's a see-through, what's known in the term as a see-through lease. Very frankly, the entity issuing entity has no liability. The credit of the company is the thing the bondholder investor looks to.
If the company should default or can't make payments on the bond, how does that affect the credit of the...
Probably get frankly from real experienced investment bankers, of which I'm not one, two opinions given a large project in a small state with relatively little financing. There's no question that such a default could have had a negative reaction. Other financial people point to the fact that West Virginia Turnpike, which is a toll road, has been in default for 15 years, yet West Virginia GO bonds continue to sell it. But the answer to your question is it depends on the situation very specifically in the environment.
Do a poor job in selecting credits. If we had several of them on there that were weak, that might be one thing. But if we have one bad apple out of barrel, it's a different situation.
Mr. Chair.
There are means that you could take the to ensure that the bond ways to accomplish that it's safe financing. So you get, even though it's just one small name, you get an insurance company behind it.
Commissioner, under this, you can monitor those prudent controls. Or
yes.
Chad?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm toying with here is rather than taking the Band-Aid approach, Fred, of adding, as we suddenly realize, is trying to get more broad and general terms so we can do it once and have it done forever. for example, why it's very possible, as I read this now, if you have it, why it's very possible that next year you may come in and say, well, this bill is not very clear, but I want to have this authority in a position to handle telecommunications.
If that isn't allowed in the Internal Revenue Code.
Okay, that's where my trap is. Huh?
Yeah.
Can we do everything that's allowed with does
no.
this permit us to do everything
no.
that the Internal Revenue
things
Code
that we didn't
does?
Allow under that were sports facilities, convention, trade show facilities.
That are allowed in the federal.
That's yes. right, and there was that recognition in the draft that he says that I think the thing that may confuse people, the public, in reading this is that the fact that something is authorized means something can be done. And so a decision was made in the draft in the states to limit it to those facilities which currently look as though they had a financeable possibility. Memorandum, which I guess I shouldn't delay passing out any further. If I may, Mr. Chairman, and there are copies for all.
Thanks.
Outlines the full ambit of congressionally authorized purposes, which we are close to, without do not include all of in the draft legislation. Most of what's in the memorandum I've recited. The legislation was enacted in 67 before the amendment of the Internal Revenue Code, which specifically limited industrial and all law purposes. And in 68, of course, the Congress specified those which could be financed even though taxable users were to enjoy the benefits of the financing and the use of.
One of the things that we tried to accomplish in Section 2 was the prior board required that we have, anytime you have municipality involved, they have three local members and three state members. Well, if you got a Weeds, we're trying to do a multiple facility loan. And, you know, we would have got five different boards together. That made the paperwork absolutely impossible to try to accomplish. There still wasn't a single local control by a prior approval, but we don't think we need to be there to follow up all the arcane paperwork. Mr. Chair.
Commissioners, several, I guess, two or three general elections ago, they put up, in fact, the second one appeared in the special election against Congressman Don Young and Emil Nadi. But there were a bunch of convention facilities, I think it was the one before that in the general election, and if he came up in the special election, they both failed. But, so I guess we have the track record of police trying to put up convention facilities, general obligation bonds. This wouldn't make any sense to allow that here. I mean, I'm not really trying to pack the water for the purpose of it.
Well, you have to have a credible borrower. I don't see any on the horizon. If there were some on the horizon, I could credit them. If you come in and build one to do it, I might be willing to spend it for them. But I just don't want to put up a false front and let them all come pounding at the door. I'd like to first see the model in sight and before it's
amended. And then possibly attempt to amend it next year or something. Yeah, so.
Chair.
Does it work the other way around, though, why not? Well, Alaska Airlines, you know, the first here is Alaska Airlines. Alaska Airlines, credible model, it's time to amend the law to take care of it. There aren't many in that business that are big enough to handle maybe some international hotel chains there.
Chen.
Mr. Chairman, Eric, not Eric, Sterling, The only reason I think I heard you say is why you didn't want it. You were on the authority, correct. And so the only reason for not broadening this for any other things is you don't want so many people knocking on your door. Is that what I hear you say?
If I saw a credible borrower in sight, I'd be happy to expand it. But I don't see any credible borrowers. I mean, Sheffield can't sell bonds in the open market. They don't have the financial history, the the wherewithal to sell a credible bond.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, that there, and there may never be any, but I come to the point again, other than having maybe more people beating a path to your door on things that are, who are not creditable, why don't you have, while we're playing with this thing, why don't we make it permissive so that you can...
I guess I have to take, if I may, I'm going to blame for that, having drafted the act initially, and watched various attempts to work with the fuel industry that I took perhaps the wrong end of the view of the telescope. One or two reasonably small financings which would indicate a feeling of comfort with the state administration and the legislature and try out what's better.